We had spoken to every bank in the country before the Big Billion Day sale, telling them that we are going to try and get 40, 50, 60 million people to transact in one day. They laughed us out of the building. We asked all the banks, give us APIs, we'll build a new network for peer-to-peer and merchant payments. They laughed us out of the building.
You saw it coming, you were prepared. Demon, of course, helped you, but it's not like the ecosystem went along.
And I think sometimes in life, you need luck or timing. We had both. Luckily, there was very little competition pre-Demon.
Yeah.
And after Demon, we just grew like a virus.
Welcome to Unstarted. What is unique about this show is this is about you. It is for founders, by founders. I am very excited to have a celebrity founder whose product, I'm told now, 700 or 800 million people use. Probably half of you are definitely going to be users of his product given the market share. Sameer Nigam, founder of PhonePe. Very, very good to have you here. Congratulations on all that you have achieved over the years. One of the reasons we do this podcast is that a lot of the celeb stories like yours from the outside are very intimidating to many in the audience. But I know you now for maybe more than 10 years, you know Vikram even longer. And I know that's not the case. You're probably one of the nicest, most accessible founders I've met. I think you have a story that has its own ups and downs. And the goal of this podcast is to actually bring all of that out. But really privileged to be hosting you here. And thank you for doing this.
Privilege is all mine. Now you have me on the back foot. You know how much I like the celebrity tag. I quite hate it, so thank you.
So let's start just to set context. Let's go all the way back. I know you know you have one of those gilded resumes to start, but what was the family background? Did you think that you would always be an entrepreneur growing up? And then we'll get to the rest of the story, especially some of the early failures.
So my dad was an IITian who joined the Indian Navy.
Oh wow.
Family of bureaucrats, IAS, IPS. He joined Navy, was mostly with DRDO and Azagon Doc. So he liked the big bang capital projects. 20 years in, he left and joined Larsen & Toubro. Mr. Naik started this immediately at liberalization, aerospace, nuclear, defense. So he was involved for the entire decade of Ariane getting built, PSLV 2 and 3, and a lot of sort of long track projects, capital projects, and nation building projects. So there's a flavor of that in what we try and do is really think scale. Think pan India, what's good for the country. My mom, on the other hand, was a biophysics PhD who somehow made it into TCS in the first 50 employees, like with Mr. Kohli. And she had a prolific career of her own, and she actually started a tech venture in the early 80s when she used to tell me that to open a bank account, she would need either a spouse or a father to co-sign because you couldn't own a bank account without a male along with you.
Oh, wow.
This is, and from those days, I mean, I think the entrepreneur in me got activated by just watching the grind you go through, but just the sense of ownership and pride in what you build.
But pretty middle class upbringing.
Very middle class. Life was good, no complaints. I mean, naval housing and naval life is good. But this is, again, 70s, 80s, 90s in India. It's the difference between the have-nots. The spectrum was much narrow anyway. So I think from there, moved back to Bombay in the 90s. Formative years was more in Delhi, so you got a lot of that sort of political, bureaucratic vibe around. Yeah. And then you suddenly move into the peak sort of business market environment. All my friends in high school suddenly were, instead of being kids of some government officer or the other, everyone's running small businesses, mid businesses, large size businesses. So I think the bug bit me by college. I was certain I actually want to venture out. I think some sage advice, my dad pushed me to go and get my master's after my undergrad, said, get your technical expertise in and go as deep as you can, apprentice, because you're starting with a handicap. You're not a business family.
Would that advice still apply today? I have many people, I'm sure you have, who come to us in college, sometimes ready to drop out. World has changed, AI has happened. Today when people come to you, so you are clear you want to be an entrepreneur. Should you be going deeper in education or not?
I wouldn't use the word education because I think that's something that you can actually get by yourself. If you're just talking about sort of academic textbook learning, and in the AI world, that's becoming easier. I think what I hold sacred, 4 years plus two on the engineering side, I think the love and passion for building came through. I wasn't the best engineer. My co-founder, in fact, was the university topper. But I think if you are, especially if you're trying to play sort of in the digital, consumer, deep tech, anything to say where you say tech, if you don't understand technology at its core, you'll be taken for a ride no matter what.
You won't get in college then. So are you saying?
I'm saying that I think college gives you the foundation.
But you have to get work experience?
So after that, I jumped straight to the other end. I went into a startup where there was maybe a 50-person tech team for 5 or 6 years. So I got to work on everything of everything.
Yeah.
Infrastructure layer to the application layer. So I think experience trumps everything, absolutely no doubt. And I think today kids can aspire to learn on the job. I think that has changed. But even today, I mean, I'm almost 50. We hire lots of interns, we hire college grads, we hire laterals. Those who've had a really good solid grind in a good college outlast and outshine those who are self-trained more often than not. That rule still holds.
That's think even in the world of AI?
In fact, exponentially more.
Why?
So yesterday, I think Sundar put out the statement saying 75% of the code in Google's being generated by AI now. 6 months ago, that number was 50%. But he also added that the best of the engineers and architects are the ones who are actually always going to be there because they're actually vetting what the AI is putting out.
No, so this is a very important takeaway. You are saying, because there's this whole narrative about losing jobs, this, that, you are saying grounding yourself.
So, the best architects will never be out of a job. The best designers will never be out of a job. I think the ones who are sort of working on the thin application layer using toolkits, what you could do with a toolkit, the toolkit can do without you perhaps today. But if you're talking about like at our scale, right, just prolific volumes of transaction activity out of PhonePe, the concurrency levels are so high, 25, 30, 40,000 transactions a second at peak. The systems we design, the data centers we build out, the SRE teams, if you don't understand tech at the core, you can't learn on the job.
What about other functions other than, so for tech, very clear, be in the top 25%, be the people who have good education background and then clearly good hands-on experience. How does this translate to other functions?
So product, marketing, I'd say today even just entrepreneurship. If I knew then what I know now, I would have jumped in 8 or 10 years ago. But there, I think familial upbringing or environment really matters. So a lot of my friends went into their businesses much earlier than I did because the environment actually encourages it. Risk-taking, I'm happy to see multiple clusters of entrepreneurship coming into India now. But generally in the North Belt, it was about the 4, 5, 6 year grind of UPSC. In the heartland, it used to be, beta JEE ke liye padho ya do your AIIMS exams. Bombay and Gujarati families, Marwadi families used to be prolific at business. So no matter what you were trying, you'd get encouragement. We used to get discouragement.
Yeah.
And I mean, even when I joined the first startup I was working at, this is in California, peak sort of startup activity. My dad was furious that I gave up a job at Microsoft. That's what I got on campus. So I think quality and developer testing, employee number 1,242,000. I would have died like creatively.
Yeah.
But that was the market. Today, my son's heading into college. I'd be thrilled if he actually started venturing out right now.
Dropping. So I thought you were saying.
I'm not saying drop out. I'm saying start rolling the dice because today you can. You can start your first venture while you're in school.
This is very, very good. So you are saying that go to college, get education, go get real apprenticeship experience. That is the path. Continue with that, but start side hustles. Your
Absolutely.
Own businesses right now.
And start making somebody, mistakes early.
You know, somebody who's a great entrepreneur, investor, I don't recall, he said, you must start making your first money in college.
Yeah.
And today that's much easier.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's a great takeaway. Coming back to your journey, let's fast forward. Got great background. Where did it lead to? It led to some startup. Let's talk through that and where did that take?
So I think 6 or 7 years working in a startup, felt comfortable that I know I can build, I understand the consumer side, learn some marketing, was ready to roll. I didn't know finance, I didn't general fear of things like law and compliance, because we're coming from an environment where governance has to be strong, right? Just can't do anything. So I'm like, okay, what do I do with this? I ended up at Wharton, complete sort of opposite environment from Los Angeles on all dimensions. I'm surrounded suddenly with kids who want to become aspiring hedge fund managers, private equity folks. They're speaking a different language. I think, again, just learning from the professors there, learning from my peers, in fact, the language of business is very different than the language of technology, completely different. It gave me more confidence to venture out. I started my first venture during B-School. I co-opted my co-founder. He actually had an idea for a real estate venture in India. He was also moving back after 10 years in the States. So he was trying to replicate Zillow. I thought replicating iTunes was better.
And you knew him before?
I knew him from undergrad. We've known each other 31 years now.
So let's pause on that, because we had a question on exactly this topic.
My question is related to co-founders. How critical is it to have a co-founder when you're trying to raise money? And how much of it is a deal breaker when you're talking to an investor? The second is, if you had to get in a co-founder, if you haven't had one from the beginning, what is the chemistry? What should you keep in mind when getting that person in? And the third thing is, what's the right fit? So if it's not your partner, a family member, who can fit that bill, and what are the signs that you can look for?
So let me pick up the first. For as investors, don't decide to have a co-founder because of investors. Decide if you do. If we answer the next two questions, that answers the first question. If you're doing it for the right reasons, that's what investors look at. So you are ready. So
yeah.
I think your and Rahul's, Chari's story is just very inspiring. 31 years, probably longer, not probably, longer than a marriage, and yet happily together. At least that's how you guys project it. So how did it start? And to answer the questions, how do you think about this?
So, Chari and I got along pretty damn well in college as well, and we worked on a college fest together. So we went to investors, then there were sponsors. We pitched our college fest, we raised a bunch of sponsorship, we organized it, 300 or 400 students. I think we liked working well together. I think his journey was way more on the deep tech side. He was Sun Microsystems, Cisco, Andiamo. Mine was on the consumer internet side. So we were loosely in touch for about a decade. Around the same time, both got married. Just around the same time, we were thinking about starting families and moving back to India. This is 2009. We met at a batchmate's wedding and got chatting, and we said, let's try something together. It's been 10 years. We have a bunch of learnings. India's looking really exciting. We always wanted to move back, both of us. So he said, let's get together and try something. I think to the question asked, I'd answer it in two parts. We didn't know when we became co-founders what exactly we'll do. But there's a very strong interest in technology, and that gives you a very wide range, consumer internet specifically. And the second was, there's a very strong alignment of values. And if you've grown up together since you're 17, I've known his wife now for 30 years. She was a junior in college. He's known mine for 20 some years. I think that outlasts everything, by the way. The ups, the downs, the grind, the successes, the failures. If you know what you want out of venture very early on as co-founders, that's the person to stick with. The roles will evolve. I mean, you know this better than most, right?
Yeah. But the value system, because the question also asked family member, actually doesn't matter, at least in my view, although it's the minority. you said value system. Was the alignment on what space you guys would want to work in? Was the complementarity of skill sets also key?
So, yes and no. I think the roles we enjoyed more, there's complementarity. Rahul loves product, owns technology, all the way down to infrastructure where he meets Burzin. I love product to consumer, marketing, brand building. And someone has to do the responsibility part of finance, being the CEO.
Yeah, yeah.
Finance, legal,
yeah.
Controllership, all of that stuff, which he would very happily divest still will. I've been trying to con him into switching roles, he won't. So I think the roles kind of divided each other. But it's a pretty nice spectrum, because if I'm tied up with a fundraise, he will go way deeper to the business plans itself or tracking the businesses. Rahul could actually be the CEO any day of the year. I think I could be a half-decent CTO most of the year. But I know he can go,
he so
can
he's
go
further. Better.
He's got more stretch. I think he has more stretch.
Right.
I think I have more willingness.
Yeah.
I'm willing to go into the corporate functions and own those.
Very
Rahul
good.
Is like,
very
not
good.
Really
good. Very good. Yeah. Okay. So you guys decided you would be co-founders, didn't have an idea, had some broad idea of what you would want to do, and then?
And then I think we, in that era, as you know, like a good party, love music, like dancing. iTunes had come out, the iPhone had come out, Android followed shortly after. I was still in business school, everything felt like a party. So I said, why not build an iTunes for India? I somehow convinced Rahul, who had a much better plan. He wanted to build India's Zillow. I convinced him, let's build India's iTunes. First lesson learned the hard way when we moved back to India. Study your addressable market. I think we had 10 million phones then. Half of them were
I
black.
I came back to India, started an internet company in 1999.
You were building eBay. There was no logistics. I think we...
There were no users. There were no internet users.
So... We realized a mobile first play may not really work too well.
Yeah.
Second thing, it was that the torrent era in India was at peak, and we started.
Piracy was, there were no.
It was
laws.
Insane.
Yeah.
And he said, okay. So we ended up paying minimum guarantees to every label, East and West.
What is the name of the company?
It was called Mime 360. It started off as a B2C offering. We had this little niche of maybe 10,000 users, and largely expats. Paying us $1 a pop for really, really old Indian music that we digitize. And then we had 13 million tracks for which we were paying Universal and Sony and everyone that nobody downloaded because they were freely available. And when the top of your charts in a media catalog makes zero money and you're praying that the long tail with a very small set of users will make money, you need to learn how to cut your losses. I think we got a little lucky.
I'm going to connect this back to your new business and new business model, because I'm not sure you learned your lessons then, but
well, I mean, I think we like asymmetric bets, right? So that is still playing out.
Interesting. What is an asymmetric bet?
An asymmetric bet would be that mobile-based internet consumption, I'm talking about 2011-12, mobile-based internet penetration in India will leapfrog broadband. Just because you don't need physical infrastructure.
Yeah.
You don't need cabling. Ironically for us, we sold that company in 2011 or 12 to Flipkart. The year I joined Flipkart started selling tens of millions of smartphones.
Yeah.
I mean, prices just crashed.
Why did... So the business didn't work was clear.
But we had a very good platform.
Yes.
That platform had become the back end for streaming content on platforms like Gaana and Dingaana and other players. Google Music, when it launched, had three partners. We were powering all three of them.
Yeah.
In.com, Saregama. So we were called the black box or the platform for the industry.
Yeah.
We just found B2B was easy. We were focusing on tech.
Yeah.
They were working on what they were working on. Flipkart decided to enter digital content.
Yeah.
And we built some phenomenal IP. Again, didn't make much money there. We were the only company with its own DRM tech for ebooks east of Europe.
Yeah.
Every book publisher worked with us. The tech was great. But I think we were early in our understanding of the Indian market. Even as entrepreneurs, how to think about, okay, I can have a lot of operating metrics. What will make money?
Yeah.
I think that Flipkart taught us an incredible amount of.
Awesome. And then you went on to start PhonePe.
Yeah.
I didn't think of this framework of asymmetric bet it sounds, I think, very instructional for people, because PhonePe is another asymmetric bet. So let's come to that. But it also, and it has been proven with PhonePe, just so people know, pre-COVID, wasn't Google Pay, Google higher market share, or were you guys the same, similar?
So we launched the day UPI launched.
You gained about 15-20% market share in the last 5 years, right?
No. So NPCI published the data formally in December 2020.
Yeah.
When they published it, we were over 45%, almost 50.
Already. Okay.
And we've always been the largest.
Yeah.
I think what ended up happening is in the early years, before NPCI published the data.
Yeah.
In the cities where the media's watering holes are,
yeah,
GPay's brand equity was higher, and therefore everyone assumed, because I use GPay, India uses GPay.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think we are the counterculture bet.
Yeah. No, but that's another important takeaway. Don't listen to echo chambers on what, because I don't think Sameer would have started his business if we were to listen to echo chambers. Talk more about what made you take this second asymmetric bet, having failed at the first one, but also I think one important takeaway is, even when you were taking a bet which may have failed because of market reasons, you guys were building real technology, real platforms, and that's what took the margin of safety on that bet significantly higher, and you got acquired. How did you think about it, starting the next one again at the bleeding edge?
We had term sheets to at least, like, some of the past people, somebody's willing to pay you a few million dollars, and honestly, in your first venture, the first $1 million is game changing.
Yeah. You mean for the new venture?
For the first venture, we got acquired for a few million dollars and some chunky equity at Flipkart, which was awesome.
Yeah.
I put 95% of my money in a house that I still live in.
Yeah.
I've not moved since.
Yeah, very good.
At that time, it seemed like an outrageous investment. My wife said, why are you putting all the money here? I told, if I'm successful beyond this, you'll want to move to a bigger house. So here's the bigger house. Now, I'm an alpha. I can room. Yeah. Khula sand, as they say.
Yeah.
So I can take big bets.
Yeah.
So one is big bets.
Yeah.
Second was on the PhonePe bet, and I think specifically within that, a lot of people ask us about UPI. We'd seen the absolute collapse of the Indian digital payments infrastructure at the first Big Billion Day at Flipkart. And I was heading the consumer side. Rahul was heading supply chain. We met at checkout and payments. We had spoken to every bank in the country before the Big Billion Day sale, telling them that we are going to try and get 40, 50, 60 million people to transact in one day. They laughed us out of the building. And what ended up happening is, in a span of maybe 7 or 8 hours, Flipkart had to issue a front page apology.
Yes, I remember that.
Right? Yeah. It was a lot of egg on our face. And it was very unfortunate, because what people didn't know is, behind the scenes, we took down the banking infra, not the payments infra, the banking infra. State Bank of India and Standard Chartered at that time were our cashback partners. They were down. Their CBS was down. Their ATMs were down for 7 or 8 hours. I got chewed out by every CIO in the market. Then our payment gateway banks, HDFC, Axis, I mean, you name it, public, private, they all went down. And part of the issue was that nobody had seen that kind of peak activity digitally. Wallets had just kind of started. But with wallets where you're preloading money, people ain't going to buy an iPhone using a wallet that's preloaded. Wallets were an anomaly. Everyone said the success rate is high, and it was, because you've discounted the failure during loading of the wallet. The wallet to wallet works well. The failure rate is still, like, super high, 75-80% success, whether you're paying directly on a Flipkart or you're loading a wallet. So we didn't like the wallet either. So we knew payments was a population scale opportunity slash problem to solve, very clear. E-commerce, food tech, nobody could grow if digital payments didn't grow. Cash on delivery, kitna karenge?
Yeah.
We knew wallet is not the way to solve this at scale. We started talking to the banks and saying, we'll build a brokering layer. There was another venture, I think you guys might know them, Chillard.
Hmm.
They were also trying the same. There was this platform or network called IMPS by NPCI. We asked all the banks, give us APIs, we'll build a new network for peer-to-peer and merchant payments. They laughed us out of the building.
This was as Flipkart employees
out of
or
Flipkart.
As new?
We left Flipkart.
You had left Flipkart, so we'll come to that. Yeah. That's where you cost us $1 billion. Yeah. So we'll come to
we
that.
We decided to venture out.
Yeah.
We were trying to figure out where we want to play.
Yeah.
I think from a financial inclusion standpoint, Rahul was very, very excited about that side of it. I wanted to build India's version of population scale platforms,
yeah.
the big techs. Payments is where we met in the middle. Now we have bets, yeah. some asymmetrical, some yeah. linear.
So I want to go there. I think one yeah. instructive lesson, often people say, what kind of business should I start? And we say lived experience. You guys lived the experience with the big billion sale and therefore had a very clear, deep understanding of what was broken. And then you had a thesis on the solution, yeah. which we'll come to. Connecting back to the previous music situation, why would this not be another repeat of that where you're calling the market wrong?
Oh, okay. So one, I mean, at scale, we'd seen the size of the market. We were 4 years further along, having seen and interacted with some prolific investors and advisors during the Flipkart years as well. I think we'd learned how to size the Indian market, the today and the tomorrow, way better. I mean, you're 4 years into the market.
And you experienced, the big billion day failure was not because the users weren't there,
yeah.
but because the infra broke.
So mine was on me.
Yeah.
I sized the wrong market. I didn't understand the dynamics of that sector either.
Yeah.
Here, we were playing at least to experience. We had the understanding. We were playing to our strengths because payments is inherently a tech and IP play.
Yeah.
It is utilitarian. So I think we knew that payments was a sector where we had a decent chance. Regulation was a new domain for us.
Yeah.
But again, most of the folks that have been really prolific worldwide told us the entrepreneurs that actually survive and thrive in this space are those that actually imbibe regulation, not oppose it.
Embrace, yeah.
You have to disrupt.
Yeah.
So challenger's job is to push,
yeah.
and we do. God knows, we trouble our regulators a lot. But governance has not been in question.
Yes.
So
yes.
I think we had the basic ingredients.
Maybe we'll come to that later, but I thought you guys are really, the regulators like you, but we'll come back to that. So you're now starting the business. We have also given you a term sheet at that stage, and that's how it cost us $1 billion. So let us take one more question and then tell us through this whole story of how did you decide what to do, and then mm-hmm. going back to Flipkart.
Hi, I'm Timu, and I'm product manager right now, and I'm an aspiring founder. So my question is to kind of understand the rationale behind how do you kind of crystallize your ICP, right? Like how do you ruthlessly prioritize your product pricing and features for your ICP and not kind of accommodate the noise from the rest of the crowd?
So Sameer, you are in my view, a idol for people who are trying to be forward leaning into new trends. So with this question, I won't interrupt mm-hmm. you. Go through the thought process of how did you guys think through this
okay.
and come up with the product, and how did you validate that this would potentially work?
So I mentioned the learning from a big billion day. That's just learning in a segment. I think life stage and self-awareness was important. As I mentioned, because now you have the security blanket, you sort of got a house. We're not very driven by money. We didn't come from that much money, both Rahul and myself. So this question of who your customer should be was a question that every VC asked us. And we struggled with this one because, one, we believe payments is something that should be solved for everyone. It can literally, is the bridge between an informal and formal economy, is the bridge between no financial inclusion and inclusion. So at a mission level or a vision level, we were very, very clear we want to swing for the fences and go for a billion. It's not an asymmetrical bet. It's a long-term bet. And if vision doesn't outlive targets, then it's not a vision at all. So, and I think repeat founders find it easier to be fair. It's hard for young entrepreneurs, unless there's a problem you've personally dealt with, to say, I'll spend 20 years doing this. I think for us, we just said, we want to now solve big, hairy problems. Because small cohort problems wouldn't excite you after Flipkart. Then I'd just be at Flipkart for 10 years. So we knew we wanted to do something at population scale. We knew payments would be a great problem to solve. We knew it would be hard. I know you guys were actually great, and Vikram was, in giving us that room early on with the term sheet. And I remember we got another one on top. You allowed us to shop, which was very generous. But if you remember by then, Paytm had probably raised about $500 or $600 million. I used to see free charge and MobiKwik. Wallets were the flavor of the month. And if the flavor of the month has there's four or five of these flavors and everyone's eating ice cream and you're trying to tell people there's a better dessert out there, it's kind of hard. So we knew that our odds are very low. And because we knew the odds are low, we wanted to buy ourselves time, not money. Ultimately, we chose to merge back with Flipkart as an independent BU. One, the familiarity. Two, they were very well capitalized. Three, even though they had a board and we used to present to the board, for us, really effectively, if Sachin and Binny were spiritually aligned,
yeah,
we had a lot more runway.
So Sachin and Binny, you also cost us $1 billion.
Yeah.
But they pulled a, this was the ghar vapsi.
This was the ghar vapsi.
Yeah.
And I think we solved perhaps a problem for them as well, because there's a lot of Flipkart mafia churn at that time. Binny just taken over as CEO and he said, I'll pull half of them back, you pull the other half back. And I think the first couple of 100 employees we had were all ex-Flipkart. So I think it just gave us the time to bet on something like a UPI, which is very nascent, or even building. We started out, when we talked to you, with building our own brokering layer. Then some serendipity, Nandan and gang, some hackathon here with RBI. We said, we'll go all in on UPI. Fast forward 6 months, you're still sitting with sandboxes. Fast forward 12 months, you launch. Most of the banks were not there. State Bank, HDFC, it's still not looking like a great bet.
Yeah.
But then demon happens. And I think sometimes in life, you need luck or timing. We had both. We were the only fintech really that launched. Half the banks didn't have apps. No wallet company would ever bet on UPI, because why would you? You gone and told all your investors that I'm the best thing since sliced bread. So luckily there was very little competition pre-demon.
Yeah.
And after demon, we just grew like a virus.
What was the quality of your infra by the time of demon?
Your tech? The design, we spent an obsessive amount of time on designing our own infra.
Yeah.
We've always had our own data centers managed. We've not changed, Raul's talked about this often, we've not changed the core design patterns.
Yeah.
There's a noisy architecture that allows us to scale very, very rapidly.
And I think that's a big takeaway, because I see that pattern between your first failure and the second outside success, that you guys always focus on building the right foundation.
Tech has to be in the bag.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, if you're playing for population scale, you can't re-engineer everything at the foundational level
yeah.
as you go.
Yeah.
You can change the facade, you can change the interiors, you could probably knock down the structure. Yeah. But man, if you have to change down the foundation, you're starting from the ground up every time.
Going back to the question, were you clear? You said some of this iterated. Were you clear of the ICP? It sounds like the ICP never iterated. It was always population scale, but the way to get to the ICP iterated. What is the...
No, so in fact, this is I think the answer is category specific. If I were doing QC today, I would still be starting in the metros. Because you know the purchasing power is different. The purchasing
QC
power
is quick commerce.
Quick commerce.
Yeah.
Or food tech or anything else, right? Or fast fashion.
Yeah.
You have to have density. It just makes you look better. It convinces VCs to put more money in.
Yeah.
Then you move to 15 cities and the PE boys come. There's a playbook that both investors and, by the way, customers also. I call this the customer playbook.
Yeah.
Customers in B30 will dictate what happens in tier 4, 5, 6.
Yeah.
Right? The beyond 30. You have to do well in the metro, even as a fashion brand. If you don't do well in Bangalore and Mumbai and Pune and Delhi, people are not trying you in state capitals. You have to do well.
Yeah.
But in something like payments, which is like bijli, if I can make a digital payment sitting at home and pay my electricity bill, I'm saving half a day.
Yeah.
In fact, the further you go in the hinterland, the more time you save.
Very good. Yeah.
Right? This is counterintuitive to people sitting in cities in India. The amount of value add a phone pay does for somebody who has to go and pay a bill for a gas cylinder 1.5-2 hours away in the closest little city is way more than what I offer you here.
So in the vitamin versus painkiller framework, you are saying you are even bigger painkiller in the hinterland.
Absolutely, no question.
Yeah.
No question.
Perfect.
I mean, you don't need digital payments.
Yeah.
You had a card.
I had a driver who would go and
You had a driver who'd pay it.
Yeah.
My driver needed it.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, wonderful. Demon has come. You are ready. Let's take the next question, because you may be ready, but the ecosystem may not have been ready for you. So, knowing your timing, How can founders assess whether they are early, late, or correctly timed for a market opportunity, especially in rapid evolving sectors? And I think you said that you got lucky. You didn't, in my view. You saw it coming. You were prepared. Demon, of course, helped you. But it's not like the ecosystem went along. So what were your signals that you were on the right path, and how did some of that path play out?
So I think one of the difficult learnings as an entrepreneur, at least for me, some get luckier. I'd rather be best than first in a sector.
Interesting.
In digital music, we came first. We ended up serving everybody else as a B2B platform that came after us, in fact. In .com and Ghana, we ended up becoming their backend because we didn't have the runway or the strategy or the timing to do it. With payments, the wallet guys came before us. Visa and MasterCard came before us. We knew payments is a pain point that we even, all of us felt. Always loading, sort of going to the ATM, withdrawing cash, getting sciatic, butt pain. Like, who wants to do that? So we knew that we're not early as far as the problem to be solved. We were seeing this in e-commerce. We were seeing this offline. So the sector, the timing wasn't early. We knew we were very early to UPI. There, it was a technology and product bet both. We believed that if wallets were going to reach 200-300 million users, then 200-300 million people still need to load a wallet with the same infrastructure that's broken. So you can't have an Ali or WeChat moment in India unless you fix that. That wasn't happening with cards. So anyway, you have to solve the root cause problem. Second, we were very sure that if you're building with UPI from the get-go, even if it looks like a 0.1% chance, if the regulators aligned, if every Indian has a bank account or near that, Jandan was happening at scale, the market infra is laid out, and the government is also pushing it. If those three market forces come together, I have not seen in a market that eventually things don't tip in your favor. We just didn't know how much time.
Were there any lots of, you're saying, the stars are aligning, right? Bottoms up indicators were also coming, and talk about, it seemed like at one point the ecosystem was punching back for some reason.
The incumbents were punching back. So I think Demon happened, as I mentioned, only a few of the banks were there. Feb, 3 or 4 months in, we announced that we already have 10 million users in a quarter or two. ICICI Bank at the time, for some peculiar reason, they just started blocking all transactions that were initiated with the PhonePe app. Press release on a Monday, we appealed to NPCI, they said no, the bank's in the wrong. Then some lobbying happened, they said no, we are in the wrong. Then the regulator, for the first time, I went to the RBI office. It's quite intimidating as a kid. And we pled our case saying, we are certified, we've done all the testing, what's wrong? I think if I reflect back today, what was happening was the banks believed that it was their birth given right to win the UPI game. And the TPAPs were just some experiments that would run on the periphery. The market opened up so fast because of demonetization that the banks, from a basic product standpoint, realize, I shouldn't have built UPI apps only for my captive user base, my banking user base. PhonePe's built an app that any bank's customer can use. It just changed the paradigm. Your bank didn't matter. The application was payments first. And they pushed back. And then there was a couple of years of lobbying. The wallets came at us. Everybody came at us. That's the best validation you can get. If your regulator's happy with you, if your customer's happy with you, and all incumbents are hating on you, you're in the right market.
Very good. It's the best validation. It's not just in India. It's global. I know you're familiar with this new agentic framework that came out called OpenClaw, then Anthropic blocked. And to your point, the customers are happy. Regulators in this case don't care. Then you will ultimately prevail.
Yeah.
So congratulations, Samir. Fast forwarding, what do you know from your vantage point as owning half of payments in the country that we would not know? Like interesting tidbits. What is happening in India in the hinterland? What do people pay for?
So I think this is the 10th year of PhonePe. We are starting to put out a lot of very, very interesting factoids on our website called pulse.phonepe.com. I'm doing a plug.
Check out pulse.phonepe.com to get factoids, yeah. But let's hear it from you.
I think the thing we are proudest of in those 10 years, and I think the ecosystem as well, today for us is a very special day. We crossed 700 million users today. In 10 years, as an ecosystem that didn't exist, I think it's fair to say that we have connected India in a manner that was unimaginable. As an ecosystem, as a company, we feel very proud of the fact that we are able to actually improve lives and drive inclusion. And it's not lip service. I was talking about bill payment effort. If I asked you today to go and pay your BESCOM bill by standing in a line, those 4 hours, you know how valuable they are. In our consciousness, we never thought about how valuable they could be to our drivers, to our maids, to somebody in a tier two who's actually every day earning their income by doing small tasks. It's a lot of time back in the economy.
It's a ease of living driver.
At a population scale, it's so inclusive. I think that wakes me up every day excited about getting back to work, right?
Any interesting factoid we would see that you want to share?
My favorite one, which I keep telling people, and I'm a Bombay born kid. South Bombay, life till date, 10 years in, never made it into the top 7 districts in Maharashtra on digital payments. Still doesn't, fiercely.
To all my friends in South Bombay, superb. One of the most anticipated IPOs of the year until you were not. Multi-part question. Did you start the company thinking that you would take it public? How did that thought process evolve as a founder, CEO to say, do I want to be public? Do I not want to be public? And anything you want to share on the most anticipated IPO?
I think all founders hope that the company is successful enough where either one day you could take it public, or if your last name is Kamat, you just never need to take it public, right? But I think for the nature of our business, for the population scale we play at or aspire to play at, the number of regulated businesses we operate, I think it was both inevitable and desirable.
So it's a feature in some ways, right? For governance.
Both a long-term strategic advantage to aspire to that level of governance and demonstrate it, as well as a necessity. So I think that was inevitable in our business. In fact, I think we'd set the wheels in motion with our pretty famous Ghar Vapsi when we moved back domicile from Singapore to India. We seem to pay a lot of money every time we take these actions. Last time was $1 billion paid by
you
Walmart.
You always in the billion. You cost us $1 billion, but you gave the government $1 billion.
Government got $1 billion from Walmart and all the other investors so we could move. Then we were all on ESOPs. We ended up converting them into equity and ended up paying, I think, out of pocket a couple of thousand crores each on that. We paid the tax, but we don't have the liquidity. It's pretty awesome. but I think the IPO is inevitable in my mind. It's just the right answer for a company of PhonePe's profile. As far as the timing. As I mentioned, I mean, the only thing I can really say here is we were almost there. That is recorded. We filed our DRHP, the second one, the DRHP 1.
UDRHP.
The UDRHP. So everything is ready. We've done all our financials, our circle apps. We published our financials. We spoke to our board on a Friday. And on a Saturday, bombing starts. And when bombing starts, and this is something people forget, in a very, very short window of time in those 7 days, every country from Pakistan and Afghanistan, which people forget, to the Gulf countries through Iran, Russia and Ukraine, you could draw a crescent moon and every country between us and Ukraine was at war.
Yeah.
There was 7 or 8 countries.
Yeah.
We just didn't feel like this is...
Probably as close to, in our lifetimes, a world war equivalent.
It was looking like one thing goes wrong further, it could be a world war.
It could tip over.
So, wasn't a popular decision, but just had to convince Rahul and then core management team and then talk to the board. They were great about it. I'll say this. We just told them, we'll wait for things to get to some level.
Tell me, Sameer, Zomato went public also, if I recall correctly, at very bad times.
No. They went at the peak of the bubble.
I thought that was
2021.
Okay.
They got hammered for a few months from whatever, 12 billion to 6, and then they bounced back. And Blinkit actually came in. If you remember, when they put in $500 million in Blinkit, the markets came
at them. Yeah, they tanked. Yeah. Interesting. Okay. So you want more stability, but we look forward to seeing you soon in the public markets. People watching you are very inspired by you. What do you have to share? As there are so many takeaways, which we'll have ideable moments, starting with your asymmetric bets, actually going back to education, side hustle, asymmetric bets, so many learnings. What do you want to share from your perspective to people watching this and saying, I want to be Sameer one day and affect things at population scale?
So, one, I would not advise anyone to try and be me. Mm-hmm. Everyone should just find, when the keeda hits, take the step. As I said, I mean, if I was 20 years younger, I would venture out and try and figure out. There's always something new and exciting you could actually do. But be honest with yourself. Don't do it because people are doing it in FOMO. Don't become an entrepreneur by mistake. Be very clear. This is a journey, a grind that you and you alone are willing to go through. If you find a co-founder who's willing to go through it, it's like a marriage, go through it with them. But don't do it because of FOMO. I'm finding a lot of people almost, it's gone from never work in a startup to everyone must. I think the experience is great. You can work in a startup. But if you get in, back yourself. The younger you are, the less you have to lose. Anyone telling you you're losing out, life's a very long journey. Keep rolling the dice.
Perfect. I think in the worst case, failure in doing entrepreneurial journeys is also success. The amount you learn, and of course, if you're Sameer, you get bought by Flipkart as well. Thank you for doing this, Sameer.
Thank you.
Congratulations on everything that you have achieved, and Godspeed on the future.
Thanks, Avnish. Thank you.
Cheers.
You're watching Z47 Moments, the podcast by India's oldest venture capital firm, Z47. If you like this episode, consider hitting the subscribe button and the bell icon so you never miss an update from Z47 Moments.